Shaza Courtney was determined that his sons would not grow up believing that the affluent white suburbs of Cape Town and Johannesburg were all of Africa. This safari was to show them the old Africa, primeval and eternal, and to establish for them a firm link with their history and their ancestors, to engender in them a sense of pride in what they were and in those who had gone before them. He had set aside 6 whole weeks, the full period of the boys' school holidays, for this venture, and that had taken a great deal of planning and considerable heart-searching. The affairs of the company were so many-faceted and complex that he did not like leaving them, even in such capable hands as those of David Abrahams. The shaft sinking at Silver River was going ahead apace, and they were down almost 1,000 feet already, while work on the plant was also far advanced. Apart from that, the first 6 pilchard trawlers for the factory at Walvis Bay were due for delivery in 3 weeks' time, and the canning plant was on the water from the suppliers in the United Kingdom. There was so much happening, so many problems, that could demand his immediate decision. Santan was, of course, always on hand for David to consult with, but of late she had withdrawn more and more from the running of the company, and there were many eventualities that might arise that could only be dealt with by Shaza personally. Shaza weighed up the chances of this happening against what was necessary, in his view, for his son's education and understanding of their place in Africa, and their inherited duties and responsibilities, and decided he had to risk it. As a last resort, he arranged a strict itinerary for the safari, of which both Santan and David had a copy, so that they would know exactly where he was during every day of his absence, and a radio contact would be maintained with the Hani mine, so that an aircraft could reach any of his camps in the deep bush within 4 or 5 hours. "If you do call me out, then the reason had better be ironclad," Shaza warned David grimly. "This is probably the only time in our lives that the boys and I will be able to do this." They left from the Hani mine the last week in May. Shaza had taken the boys out of school a few days early, which in itself was enough to put everybody in the right mood and ensure a splendid beginning. He had commandeered 4 of the mine's trucks and made up a full team of safari boys, including drivers, camp servants, skinners, trackers, gun-bearers, and the chef from the Hani Mine Club. Of course, Shaza's own personal hunting vehicle was always kept in the mine workshops, tuned to perfection and ready to go at any time. It was an ex-army jeep, which had been customised and modified by the mine engineers without regard to expense. It had everything from long-range fuel tanks and gun racks to a shortwave radio set, and the seats were upholstered in genuine zebra skin, while the paintwork was an artistic creation in bush camouflage. Proudly, the boys clipped their Winchester .22 repeaters into the gun rack beside Shaza's big .375 Holland & Holland Magnum, and dressed in their new khaki bush jackets, scrambled into their seats in the jeep. As was the right of the eldest, Sean sat up front beside his father, with Michael and Gary in the open back. "Anybody want to change his mind and stay at home?" Shaza asked as he started the jeep, and they took the question seriously, shaking their heads in unison, eyes shining and faces pale with excitement, too overcome to speak. "Here we go, then," Shaza said, and they drove down the hill from the mine offices with the convoy of 4 trucks following them. The uniformed mine guards opened the main gates and gave them a flashy salute, grinning widely as the jeep passed, and behind them the camp boys on the backs of the open trucks started to sing one of the traditional safari songs. "Weep, O you women, tonight you sleep alone. The long road calls us, and we must go." Their voices rose and fell to the eternal rhythm of Africa, full of its promise and mystery, echoing its grandeur and its savagery, setting the mood for the magical adventure into which Shaza took his sons. They drove hard those first 2 days to get beyond the areas which had been spoiled by men's too frequent intrusions with rifle and 4-wheel drive vehicle, where the veld was almost bare of large game, and those animals that they did see were in small herds that were running as soon as they heard the first hum of the jeep engine, and were merely tiny specks in their own dust by the time they spotted them. Sadly, Shaza realized how much had changed since his earliest memory of this country. He had been Sean's age then, and the herds of springbok and gemsbok had been on every side, great herds trusting and confiding. There had been giraffe and lion, and small bands of bushmen, those fascinating little yellow pygmies of the desert. Now, however, wild men and beasts had all retreated before the inexorable advance of civilization deeper and deeper into the wilderness. Even now, Shaza could look ahead to the day when there would be no more wilderness, no more retreat for the wild things, when the roads and the railway lines would crisscross the land and the endless villages and kraals would stand in the desolation they had created. The time when the trees were all cut down for firewood and the grass was eaten to the roots by the goats and the topsoil turned to dust and blew on the wind. The vision filled him with sadness and a sense of despair, and he had to make a conscious effort to throw it off so as not to spoil the experience for his sons. I owe them this glimpse of the past. They must know a little of the Africa that once was, before it was all gone, so that they will understand something of its glory. And he smiled and told them the stories, reaching back in his memory to bring out for them all his own experiences, and then going back farther, to what he had learned from his own mother and from his grandfather, trying to make clear to them the extent and depth of their family's involvement with this land. And they sat late around the campfire that first night, listening avidly until, despite themselves, their eyelids drooped and their heads began to nod. On they went, driving hard all day over rutted tracks, through desert scrub and grassland, and then through Mapani forest, not yet stopping to hunt, eating the food they had brought with them from the mine, though that night the servants muttered about fresh meat. On the third day they left the rudimentary road they had been following since dawn. It was nothing more than a double track of tyres that had last been used months before. But now Shaza let it swing away towards the east, and they went on northwards, breaking fresh ground, weaving through the open forest, until abruptly they came out on the banks of a river. Not one of the great African rivers, like the Kavango, but one of its tributaries. Still, it was 50 feet wide, but green and deep, a formidable barrier that would have turned back any hunting safari before them that had come this far north. 2 weeks previously, Shaza had reconnoitred this entire area from the air, flying the mosquito low over the treetops so that he could count the animals in each herd of game and judge the size of the ivory tusks that each elephant carried. He had marked this branch of the river on his large-scale map and had navigated the convoy back to this exact spot. He recognized it by the oxbow bend of the banks and the giant makuyu trees on the opposite side, with a fish-eagle nest in the upper branches. They camped another 2 days on the southern river bank, while every member of the safari, including the 3 boys and the fat Herero chef, helped to build the bridge. They cut the Mapani poles in the forest, thick as a fat woman's thigh, and 40 feet long, and dragged them up with the jeep. Shaza kept guard against crocodiles, standing high on the bank with his .375 Magnum under his arm, while his naked gangs floated the poles out into the centre of the river and set them into the mud of the bottom. Then they lashed the cross-ties to them with ropes of Mapani bark that still wept glutinous sap, red as blood. When at last the bridge was complete, they unloaded the vehicles to lighten them, and one at a time Shaza drove them out onto the rickety structure. It swayed and creaked and rocked under them, but at last he had the jeep and all 4 trucks on the far bank. "Now the safari truly begins," he told the boys. They had entered a pocket of country protected by its remoteness and its natural barriers of forest and river from men's over-exploitation, and from the air Shaza had seen the herds of buffalo thick as domestic cattle and the clouds of white egrets hovering above them. That night he told the boys stories about the old elephant hunters, Karamojo Bell and Frederick Salus and Sean Courtney, their own ancestor, Shaza's great-uncle and the namesake of his eldest son. They were tough men, all of them, incredible shots and natural athletes. They had to be to survive the hardships and the tropical disease. When he was a young man, Sean Courtney hunted on foot in the Tsetse fly belt of the Zambezi Valley, where the temperature reaches 115 degrees at noon, and he could run 40 miles in a day after the big tuskers. His eye was so sharp he could actually see the flight of his bullet. The boys listened with total fascination, pleading with him to continue whenever he paused, until at last he told them, "Now that's enough. You have to be up early tomorrow. 5 o'clock in the morning, we're going to hunt for the first time." In the dark, they drove slowly along the northern bank of the river, in the open jeep, all of them bundled up against the cold, for the frost lay thick in the open fillets and crunched under the jeep's tyres. In the first feeble light of dawn, they found where a herd of buffalo had drunk during the night, and then gone back into the heavy bush. They left the jeep on the river bank and stripped off their padded anoraks. Then Shaza put his two Avambo trackers to the spoor, and they followed the herd on foot. As they moved silently and swiftly through the dense second-growth mapani thickets, Shaza explained all of it to the boys, speaking in a whisper and relying on hand signals to point out the different hoof prints of old bull and cow and calf, or to draw their attention to other smaller but equally fascinating animals and birds and insects in the forest around them. A little before noon, they finally came up with the herd. Over 100 of the huge cow-like beasts, with their trumpet-shaped ears and the drooping horns that gave them such a lugubrious air. Most of them were lying in the mapani shade, ruminating quietly, although one or two of the herd bulls were dozing on their feet. The only movement was the lazy flick of their tails as the stinging flies swarmed over their flanks. Shaza showed the boys how to work in close, using the breeze and every stick of cover, freezing whenever one of the great horned heads swung in their direction. He took them within 30 feet of the biggest of the bulls. They could smell him, the hot, rank, bovine reek of him, and they could hear his breathing puffing through his wet, drooling muzzle, hear his teeth grinding on his cud. So close they could see the bald patches of age on his shoulders and rump, and the balls of dried mud from the wallow that clung in the stiff black hairs of his back and belly. While they held their breaths in delicious terror and watched in total fascination, Shaza slowly raised the heavy rifle and aimed into the bull's thick neck, just forward of his massive shoulder. "Bang!" he shouted, and the great bull plunged forward wildly, crashing into the screen of thick mapani. And Shaza gathered his sons and drew them into the shelter of one of the grey tree trunks, keeping his arms around them while on all sides the panicking herd galloped, huge black shapes thundering by, the calves bawling and the old bulls grunting. The sound of their flight dwindled away into the forest, though the dust of their passage hung misty in the air around them, and Shaza was laughing with the joy of it as he let his arms fall from their shoulders. "Why did you do that?" Sean demanded furiously, turning his face up to his father. "You could have shot him easily. Why didn't you kill him?"
"We didn't come here to kill," Shaza explained. "We came here to hunt."
"But..." Sean's outrage turned to bewilderment.
"But what's the difference?"
"Ha! That's what you have to learn. That bull was a big one, but not big enough. And we have all the meat we need, so I let him go. That's lesson number one. Now for lesson number two. None of you is going to kill anything until you know all about that animal, understand its habits and life cycle, and learn to respect it and hold it in high esteem. Then, and only then." In camp that evening, he gave them each two books, which he had bound in leather with their own names on the cover: Robert's Mammals of South Africa and his Birds of South Africa. "I brought these specially for you, and I want you to study them," he ordered. Sean looked appalled. He hated books and studying, but both Gary and Mickey hurried to their tent to begin the task. Over the days that followed, he questioned them on every animal and bird they saw. At first, the questions were elementary, but he made them progressively more difficult, and soon they could quote the biological names and give him full details of sizes and body weights of males and females, their calls and behaviour patterns, distribution and breeding, down to the smallest detail. Set an example by his younger brothers, even Sean mastered the difficult Latin names. However, it was 10 days before they were allowed to fire a shot, and then it was only bird hunting. Under strict supervision, they were allowed to hunt the fat, brown francolin and speckled guinea fowl with their strange waxen yellow helmets in the scrub along the river. Then they had to clean and dress their kill and help the Herrero chef to prepare and cook it.
"Oh, it's the best meal I've ever eaten," Sean declared,
and his brothers agreed with him enthusiastically through full mouths. The next morning, Shaza told them,
We need fresh meat for the men. In camp there were 30 mouths to feed, all with an enormous appetite for fresh meat. All right, Sean, what is the scientific name for impala?
Apicaros melampus, Sean gabbled eagerly. The Afrikaners call it rooibok, and it weighs about 130 and 160 pounds.
That'll do, Shaza laughed. Go and get your rifle. In a patch of whistling thorn near the river, they found a solitary old ram, an outcast from the breeding herd. He had been mauled by a leopard and was limping badly on one foreleg, but he had a fine pair of lyre-shaped horns. Sean stalked the lovely red-brown antelope, just as Shaza had taught him, using the riverbank and the wind to get within easy shot, even with the light rifle. However, when the boy knelt and raised the Winchester to his shoulder, Shaza slipped the safety catch of his heavy weapon, ready to render the coup de grace if it was needed. The impala dropped instantly, shot through the neck, dead before it heard the shot, and Shaza went to join his son at the kill. As they shook hands, Shaza recognized in Sean the deep atavistic passion of the hunter. In some contemporary men, that urge had cooled or been suppressed. In others, it still burned brightly. Shaza and his son were of that ilk, and now Shaza stooped and dipped his forefinger in the bright warm blood that trickled from the tiny wound in the ram's neck, and then he traced his finger across Sean's forehead and down each cheek. "Now you are blooded," he said, and he wondered when that ceremony had first been performed, when the first man had painted his son's face with the blood of his first kill, and he knew instinctively that it had been back before recorded time, back when they still dressed in skins and lived in caves. "Now you are a hunter," he said, and his heart warmed to his son's proud and solemn expression. This was not a moment for laughter and chatter. It was something deep and significant, something beyond mere words. Sean had sensed that, and Shaza was proud of him. The following day they drew lots, and it was Michael's turn to kill. Again Shaza wanted a solitary impala ram, so as not to alarm the breeding herd. But an animal with a good pair of horns is a trophy for the boy. It took them almost all that day of hunting before they found the right one. Shaza and his two brothers watched from a distance as Michael made his stalk. It was a more difficult situation than Sean had been presented with, open grassland and a few scattered flat-top acacia thorns. But Michael made a stealthy approach on hands and knees until he reached a low ant heap from which to make his shot. Michael rose slowly and lifted the light rifle. The ram was still unaware, grazing head down 30 paces off, broadside on, and offering the perfect shot for either spine or heart. Shaza was ready with the Holland and Holland to back him, should he wound the impala. Michael held his aim, and the seconds drew out. The ram raised its head and looked around warily, but Michael was absolutely still, the rifle to his shoulder. And the ram looked past him, not seeing him. Then it moved away unhurriedly, stopping once to crop a few mouthfuls. It disappeared into a clump of taller grass, and without having fired, Michael slowly lowered his rifle.